Alrighty, hello again, everyone, and welcome to it. It's the Daily Dayton Talk Podcast for the 25th day of October 2019. I am Derek Hunter. I am your host. Welcome to the program. Thank you for sharing, spreading the word, telling a friend, posting on social media, doing all those good things, writing and reviewing on iTunes and all that. And a lot of you email me and go, hey, you know, I don't have an iTunes account. How can I leave a review on iTunes? You can't. But I appreciate the thought and the effort. That, you know, that's all I ask. Tell a friend. It's every little bit helps spread the word, and you guys are the people who do it. I'm just the guy who talks and rambles, and that's all I am. You guys are the driving force behind this show, and the fact that you just send me nice emails, compliments have always made me feel weird and uncomfortable, and I tend to belittle myself in response to them, but I appreciate them. So thank you for all of that, all the great things you guys have been doing. Big show today, the big interview show. We're going to talk to author Jarrett Stepman about his new book, The War on History, The Conspiracy to Rewrite America's Past. Really enjoyed talking to him. It was a fast-moving conversation, and you'll get to that about halfway through the show. You will enjoy it, and then you'll again have a chance to enter to win a signed copy of his book, two signed copies of his book. Well, you won't win two signed copies. You'll win one, and then somebody else will win one, or at least have a chance. You know how it works. I'm over-explaining. And I'll also give away the two signed Greg Jarrett books that I have already in envelopes, just waiting to be addressed. So stay tuned for that. But until then, we have a lot of ground to cover. First things first, I want to give a shout out to Keith Hill. He became a patron on Patreon. It's very weird to say that. Say that five times fast. So thank you for that, Keith. Really, really appreciate it. I also want to give a shout out to Karen Bernetta, who didn't want to do the Patreon thing, but mailed me a check. You guys are so awesome. You're awesome. I appreciate you. I started this as a guy in a basement. I'm still a guy in a basement. But the fact that you guys support this show and spread the word and help in every way that more ways than I could have possibly imagined has been awesome. It's incredible. I sound like a moron. I keep saying awesome and everything, but thank you. There you go. Thank you. Even if you just listen and you never email and thank you. Because that's enough. That's all I ask. Everything else is bonus, is gravy. So thanks to all of you. We have a lot of things to get to in the half an hour we have together. Well, about 25 minutes, and then we'll get to the Jarrett interview, and then we'll come back and I'll draw the winners live on air. I'm going to try that. Well, live on tape. And so we'll see how that goes. I'll pull up some name I know it's going to pull up a name I'm not going to be able to pronounce, mostly because I can't pronounce most names. But first, a word from our great, great sponsor, Life Change Tea. Let me tell you about Life Change Tea. It is a game changer. Since I've been drinking Life Change Tea, I've noticed I feel so much better, and I can't tell you how much more energy I have. I think you can hear it on the program, however. How does it work? Life Change Tea is a proprietary herbal formula. It's a gentle daily cleanse designed to rid your body of harmful intruders. Let's face it, our food was different 60 years ago. Minimally processed, free of pesticides, nourishing and healthy for your body. Today, not so much. GMOs, pesticides, herbicides, and heavy, heavy, heavy processing. They're depleting the nutrition from our food. No wonder you feel so run down. You add to that all the stuff that's still in you, that gets stuck in there, phew, forget it. That's why you need Life Change Tea. Try it for yourself. Go to getthetea.com now. That's getthetea.com. Get ready for more energy. I drink it every day. I have some sitting up in the fridge right now. Drink is only as directed. It's not a chugging tea. You drink the directed amount every day, it gets you going. They say it's the tea that makes you go, and it does. And if you like chug the whole thing, if you drank like half a gallon, it'll get you going. Life Change Tea, don't do that. Don't do that. Life Change Tea is not available in stores. Go to getthetea.com. That's getthetea.com now. Enter promo code Derek at checkout, and you will receive free shipping. So congratulations to you. You're ready for the weekend, ready for the show. I'm feeling better. I still sound stuffed up, and I still have to blow my nose a lot and have a little bit of a cough. But the hot flashes, I think I'm through menopause. Those are done. And the joint ache and muscle aching is gone for the moment. Now I'll wake up tomorrow and I won't be able to move. But whatever, I'm going to enjoy the moment rather than the rest of it. Okay, let's talk about the big news that's going on there and how important, more importantly, how the big news is being portrayed by big news. The Justice Department has shifted the Durham probe into the origins of the Russia hoax to make it an official criminal investigation. This does a couple of things. It gives Mr. Durham the power to subpoena witnesses, to open a grand jury. He can charge. It's a big, big difference. Here's how Fox News is reporting it. U.S. Attorney John Durham's ongoing investigation into potential FBI and Justice Department misconduct into the run-up to the 2016 election through the spring of 2017 has transitioned into a full-fledged criminal investigation, two sources familiar with the investigation told Fox News tonight. So that's a big, big deal. The New York Times has the same story. Their headline, Justice Department is said to open criminal inquiry into its own Russia investigation. And then their subheadline is the move is likely to open the Attorney General to accusations that he is trying to deliver a political victory to Trump. Now, isn't that lovely? Here's the headline, and here's the Democratic spin. Don't read any further. Don't bother me. But don't worry. There's Democratic spin throughout. New York Times reports, quote, for more than 2 years, President Trump has repeatedly attacked the Russia investigation, portraying it as a hoax and illegal even months after the special counsel closed it. Don't you love it? Well, it was an illegal investigation, but they've stopped it. So what are you doing looking into how it started? What's the point? Now, Mr. Trump's own Justice Department has opened a criminal investigation into how it all began. Justice Department officials have shifted an administrative review of the Russia investigation, closely overseen by Attorney General William P. Barr, to a criminal inquiry, according to two people familiar with the matter. Again, those two people. Who are these two people? What's going on? The move gives the prosecutor running it, John H. Durham, the power to subpoena for witness testimony and documents, to convene a grand jury, and to file criminal charges. The open, this is where the New York Times, they already had a little bit of Democratic spin in there, but them being the New York Times, they have to continually go back to that. The opening of a criminal investigation is likely to raise alarm that Mr. Trump is using the Justice Department to go after his perceived enemies. Couple things there. Perceived enemies, I think these people have made it pretty clear they at least consider Donald Trump an enemy. Just listening to them and understanding what they've been doing and saying. But I love how, like, well, you know, this review, or what was it? The opening of it, it's going to raise alarms. It's likely to raise alarms that Mr. Trump is using the Justice Department to go after his perceived enemies. Why were there no alarms, and why are there no alarms raised about the possibility? Because there is a possibility, no matter where you fall on the spectrum of it's not likely to it's probable, there is a possibility, especially since the Mueller investigation was thorough and found nothing. There is the possibility that the Obama administration used for political purposes the intelligence community and the Justice Department to go after the Trump campaign. Probably assuming that Donald Trump was going to lose easily, but just in case they wanted to go after, destroy, or anybody associated with the Trump campaign had gotten too uppity, they would have had at the ready all of this, whatever information they gathered, while not criminal, it could be damaging personal information, they'd have it at the ready to go out there and throw down just in case somebody decided to criticize President Hillary Clinton a little too harshly. Why is there no concern about the appearance or even the prospect, the possibility that the Obama administration politicized the intelligence community and the Justice Department. Why? Because it's the New York Times. And the New York Times, that's not in the realm of possibility. It is unfathomable to leftists. Barack Obama can't take a bath. Dude floats on water. He walks on water. He doesn't sink in it. He can't sit in it. He is above reproach. Well, maybe not. We'll find out. And wherever the truth leads us, I'm ready to accept the truth. What I'm not willing to accept is people who aren't interested in getting to the truth. And people in particular who believe they already know the truth without looking. And that's what we have in the media right now. The poo-pooing of the concept of looking into this that's now turned criminal. They are offended at it. How dare you investigate Barack Obama and anybody associated with the Obama administration? Don't you know they are perfect beings? Well, this, if you're sitting there and you're thinking, Derek, you're going a little bit too far, don't you think? I mean, that's a pretty hyperbolic rhetoric. No, it's not. I have audio to prove it. Now, I could have chosen anything, but I wanted to go right to the most credible-ish person, or the one who is portrayed as the most credible and multiple award-winning journalist. We go to Andrea Mitchell, chief foreign affairs correspondent for NBC News and host of some show. She's foreign affairs correspondent for NBC News, and she has a daily show on MSNBC where she does nothing but opine about domestic politics. So what are you? You're a jack of all trades and master of none. So here is the title journalist and your own hour of television every day. She had on a little panel of two Democrats. It's hilarious how these things work. There are literally thousands upon thousands of people in Washington, D.C., former administration officials for the Trump administration, Republicans, pro-Trump people, anything. All of these people have very similar backgrounds to the guests that Andrea Mitchell managed to convene. The only difference is her guests, Wendy Sherman and Ned Price, both worked in the Obama administration. Now, when you're going to convene a panel to talk about a Republican administration and what the Republican administration is doing, if you are at all interested in fairness, even remotely, accidentally, you would have people representing both sides, especially when most of what you're going to discuss is matters of opinion. Instead, Andrea Mitchell, honest, award-winning journalist, is having none of that. She brings on two Democrats. It's like the Blues Brothers line. What kind of music do you have here? We have both kinds, country and Western. Yeah, well, what kind of opinion do you have here? We have both kinds. We have female former Democratic Obama official appointee and male former Democratic political appointee. Well, sign me up. So let's listen to this exchange and pay very close attention to, look, you get partisan hackery from the two partisan hacks you bring in. Pay attention to what Andrea Mitchell says. She is the multiple award-winning chief foreign correspondent for NBC News.
Attorney General William Barr's investigation into the origins of the Mueller probe has apparently gone a lot farther than previously known, digging into CIA and FBI decision-making under President Obama, with lead prosecutor John Durham taking on more staff in the push to speak with current and former intelligence officials in the U.S. and overseas. Among the concerns, a Western intelligence official familiar with what Durham has been asking of foreign officials says his inquiries track closely with the questions raised about the Russia investigation in right-wing media.
Immediately, because among the concerns, immediately you go to, before really explaining what's going on, among the concerns, this liberal told me that it's just a conspiracy theory that's circulated amongst right-wing media. That's some mighty fine reporting there, Andrea Mitchell. I'm no fan of Alan Greenspan, but poor bastard married her. Horrible. Just unbelievable spin setting it up. And then she introduces two Democrats, two former Obama administration officials, Wendy Sherman and Ned Price. I'll skip the intros because you don't need to hear them, and we'll go right to Andrea's questions.
Wendy, Sherman, this investigation seems to be looking into whether Ukraine and others started the Mueller investigation, whether the FBI and the CIA were wrong to have a counterintelligence investigation, and wanting to look into the background of both John Brennan and DNI Clapper, former DNI Clapper, who, of course, had a 50-plus career in the military.
You got to love that. Well, Clapper had a 50-plus year career, or 50-plus career. What the hell is a 50-plus career? And he didn't serve in the military for 50 years, Andrea. Sorry. If you're going to ask questions that are, you know, leading and biased, you should at least get the basic facts right. You should be able to string together a coherent sentence. You're reading this stuff off a teleprompter. It's words, presumably, you've gone over before this whole thing starts. I don't know. Maybe it's time to hang it up, Andrea Mitchell. Well, here's Wendy's breathy answer. She's very concerned about these things.
Yes, Andrea. From the outside, this looks like a continuation of undermining the institutions of the United States government. The theory, it appears, that Attorney General Barr is operating under is a debunked conspiracy theory that I think Ned can elaborate even more than I can. It's really crazy, to be perfectly frank. Durham is a professional, but nonetheless, it is quite concerning about what they're doing. And indeed, I think it's raising questions among diplomats around the world who are being questioned about whether, in fact, Russia was responsible for interfering in our election. Of course, they were. All of our intelligence agencies, all 17 of them, have said that they did. And we need to really be on our toes about what will happen in the upcoming election.
Couple things there. I love how she just dismissed it's a debunked conspiracy theory, and that's it. Have you noticed that's how the left talks about this? It's a debunked conspiracy. Who debunked it? Where was it debunked? By whom was it debunked? And by what evidence was it debunked? They don't ever answer that. They don't have to. They're not asked about it. It hasn't been debunked because it hasn't been investigated. It's just been declared debunked. That's what the left does. They don't like a person, you're a racist. They don't like a possibility or something that should be investigated. Oh, it's a debunked, it's a conspiracy theory. That's what they do, to just dismiss things out of hand, because they don't want to do the work, and they're probably afraid of what the work would turn up. There's been no debunking. Just because some leftist says it's debunked doesn't make it debunked. Andrea Mitchell, in theory, as a award-winning, multiple award-winning journalist, should know this. And should maybe follow up and say, well, what debunking? If you declare something debunked, how was it debunked? But she doesn't. She has no interest in that. And then at the end, Wendy there makes another bald-faced lie. All 17 intelligence agencies have declared that this was so, therefore it is so. That was never true. It was often repeated. So much so that just a quick Google search turned up some results. USA Today, back on October 21st, 2016. It's 16. So even before the election. The headline, yes, 17 intelligence agencies really did say Russia was behind the hacking of the DNC's emails. It's declared 17 agencies, and in it they cite PolitiFact, because Hillary Clinton had been repeating that 17 agencies had been behind this. Then you go to PolitiFact, and there it is. Yes, it's been rated true that 17 intelligence agencies have declared that Russia was behind the hacking of the DNC and her campaign chairman's emails. Then you read the first thing in this declaration of truth. Editor's note, we attached an update to this fact check below in response to readers' queries after subsequent testimony by James Clapper. The original fact check rating remains unchanged. And you scroll well down to the bottom through all the text that was wrong, and their update notes how James Clapper, testifying before Congress on May 8th, 2017, said that 17 intelligence agencies did not weigh in on this, which makes sense. The CIA, the FBI, and the NSA did, which is three intelligence agencies that were headed by partisan Democrats at the time who are currently involved in this probe or well-known Trump haters. That pay no mind to that. PolitiFact doesn't care. They still declare at the end, quote, "We stand by our rating." But the truth is, the 17 matters, because when you say all 17 intelligence agencies agree with something, that gives it a lot of weight. Then you look at the facts and you say, so the Coast Guard Intelligence Agency, the Coast Guard Intelligence Division, was investigating the hacking of DNC emails and of John Podesta's emails in the 2016, the Coast Guard? Why was the Coast Guard involved in that? And then you know, that just leads to more questions. That's why the left doesn't want to talk about this lie. You see, you say all 17, all of them are on board, and that sounds official, and people go, well, then it must be true if they are all on board. But they weren't all involved. Most of them would have absolutely no reason whatsoever to be involved. The Coast Guard is looking for drug smugglers making homemade submarines to get piles of cocaine through the Gulf of Mexico. They don't care about what's going on with Russian meddling in the election. They've got bigger fish to fry. They've got their jobs to do. But it sure sounds great when you say all 17. Now, theoretically, Andrea Mitchell knows this. Again, because when eventually, because the president had been decrying this, pointing it out that it was a load of crap. And eventually, once they never bothered to actually confirm it when President Trump was saying it. When James Clapper said it under oath, then suddenly they said, oh, okay, yeah, okay, it wasn't all 17. This story from the New York Times is really indicative of the media's attitude towards this. Trump misleads on Russian meddling. Why 17 intelligence agencies don't need to agree. Well, they don't need to agree. It's from July 6, 2017. President Trump said on Thursday that only three or four of the United States' 17 intelligence agencies had concluded that Russia interfered in the presidential election. A statement that, while technically accurate, is misleading. How is something that is technically accurate misleading? And suggests widespread dissent amongst American intelligence agencies when none has emerged. Right, because the rest of the intelligence agencies would have had no reason whatsoever to have been involved in the discussion in the first place. They don't deal with those sorts of things. But when Democrats were spewing this 17 intelligence agencies all agree, there was no such circumspect on behalf of the media. When the president rightly points out that no, it was three or four, not 17, only three or four out of 17, then the New York Times snaps into defensive mode and say, well, nevertheless, it doesn't really matter. There was no disagreement. He didn't say he did. But they're saying that by saying it was only three or four, that's implying that others were disagreeing. Well, if that's how you want to view it, but if that's your standard, what does saying 17, all 17 agencies agreed, imply? No answer on that. They don't care. It's a double standard, of course, because those are the only standards liberals have. The conversation on MSNBC continues.
Ned Price, you formerly were with the intelligence team as well. You were CIA. James Clapper and John Brennan would have to lawyer up. A lot of other CIA officials apparently are already lawyering up. This is getting out of bounds, is it not?
Oh, no. Democrats might have to get lawyers. They might have to hire lawyers after 3 years of everybody who worked on the Trump campaign, no matter what they did, having to hire lawyers as they were dragged continually up to Robert Mueller and before Congress. Now these Democrats might have to lawyer up. This is getting out of bounds. Why was it not out of bounds when Robert Mueller drove General Michael Flynn into bankruptcy? made him sell his house. He was forced to sell his house to pay his legal bills, forced to make a plea agreement because Mueller basically said, if you don't plead to lying to us, we're going to go after your son, too. You know, it's not enough that we ruined you. We're going to ruin your son, too. Why was that not out of bounds, Andrea Mitchell? He, too, had a long, maybe not a 50-plus career in the military, but a long and storied career in the military, Andrea Mitchell. There was no concern for him or for anybody associated with the president who had to lawyer up to go and be harassed by Democrats. But now, oh my goodness, these poor, wonderful people that I hang out with at cocktail parties are going to have to hire lawyers. This is just wrong. Cut him a check, Andrea. You and your husband are rich. Cut him a damn check, you hypocrite.
I think we have to assume, really, that this once again is Bill Barr trying to create out of whole cloth a talking point for President Trump, for President Trump to say he was treated unfairly, he was mistreated by the intelligence community. And even more concerning, I think, Andrea, this will send a signal to intelligence analysts that you should follow the truth as long as the truth doesn't lead you close to President Trump.
They have no idea what Durham has found. They have no idea what Durham is doing, but they have no restraints when it comes to dismissing whatever it might be preemptively. They don't know what the inspector general found. Allegedly, according to Fox News, the probe was turned into a criminal investigation because of the findings of Mr. Horowitz, the inspector general. So expect him, if that turns out to be true, whenever that damn report finally comes out, expect the left to turn their wrath onto him. Say, well, he's just a partisan hack. They'll find a way to label him that. This is a lot of things that you heard there on MSNBC from Andrea Mitchell. None of them are journalism. And what it shows, and what the New York Times framing of the story shows, and what so much of the so-called reporting on what William Barr shows, is that the Democrats in the media have absolutely no interest whatsoever in this investigation. It's the first and only time I can remember in my lifetime of following journalism, of following the news, where journalists are actively disinterested in the possibility of obtaining more information. It's shocking to hear. It's shocking to see. This is supposed to be their jobs, yet they have zero interest. And in fact, they're trying to undercut, and if they had their way, or one of my favorite words to say that I don't say ever, is if they had their druthers, they would actually stop this. They could have done a lot of the work that Durham is doing. Real journalists would have. Real journalists would be curious as to how something that turned out to be completely false, the Russia hoax, came into being. They would have been concerned had the intelligence agencies of the United States been spying on American citizens, especially from a rival political campaign. They would have, if the parties were reversed, you would not be able to stop the parade of outrage on every cable network and every newspaper across the country. They would be so overrun with outrage, overflowing, that they would take to the streets screaming about it. But because it's Republicans, because it's Donald Trump, they are actively trying to downplay, to the point that if Durham announced indictments tomorrow, they would barely cover it, and what they would do would be to try and poo-poo the idea. They're setting it up. They're downplaying this. This is a major, major story if it turns out there is evidence that Barack Obama's intelligence agency, and undoubtedly with his knowledge, I don't think this would have been conducted without his knowledge, had spied on the Trump campaign and helped launch a fake hoax. And, you know, just the fact that they spied on the Trump campaign and that they used opposition research obtained by from foreign governments through a foreign agent to launch that investigation, that spying, that would be a major, major story if it were a Republican who did it. Anyway, after we listen to the Jarrett Stepman interview, which I know you'll like and you'll want to enter to win to sign, a signed copy of his book, I have some audio that you're, well, you got to hear to believe. It is too, montages of the different reactions to when liberals protest and when conservatives protest. And one, you can call a mob. You can call just a bunch of angry white guys. It's all about, you can say whatever you want about Republicans. And but when it's liberals who are literally accosting people, hitting people, ripping their signs apart, banging on the doors of the Supreme Court over the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh, don't dare call them a mob. The contradiction is both hilarious and pathetically sad and frightening for the country, because journalism, in theory, is important. In practice, is a joke. So we'll have that after the interview. But right now, I give you my interview with the author of The War on History, The Conspiracy to Rewrite America's Past, Jarrett Stepman. Alrighty, hello again, everyone, and welcome to it. It's the Daily Caller podcast for the 25th day of October, 2019. I am Derek Hunter. I am your Mr. Rourke. I am your host for this wonderful podcast. And as we do every single Friday, we do an interview with somebody who has something interesting to say, and this week is no different. Our guest today is author of the new book, The War on History, The Conspiracy to Rewrite America's Past. It's Jarrett Stepman, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations on the book. I have, having done this, it's different now. When I had kids, I got a lot more sympathy for somebody who had kids. I had no sympathy before I had kids. After I wrote a book, I had a lot more sympathy because there's a lot of similarities in the birthing process. So I want to ask you a little bit about the process of the book before we get into the substance
Absolutely.
Of the book. Where the rewriting of history is all around us. What caused you, was there a particular moment or event or series of events that made you say, all right, I got to do something about this?
Yeah, it really was a lead up. I've been kind of writing about this topic for a few years, kind of the attacks on American historical figures, statues, things like that. Of course, the Charlottesville incident really threw this into overdrive, I think, where you saw a rapid pace. I think it started out with especially the Confederate statues. You had that debate and very quickly moved on to other things. And because I've written a lot about American history, first principles, I thought, you know, I need this. This is a time to write a both explain to people what this war on history is about, because I think there are a lot of people saying, well, why are these people attacking statues? Why are they going after historical figures? And then going back and making that defense of American history. You know, we have a lot to be proud of in this country. And I explain, this is why you have a reason to be proud as Americans of your history.
It's kind of funny. I was working in Baltimore at the time when the day the statues disappeared, the four statues. And believe it or not, murders continued in the city after the removal of statues. I was personally shocked. I thought they'd solved all of their problems. They can't do anything right. They can't do anything quickly except issue parking tickets and remove statues. But there was that furor over that. And it stemmed from Charlottesville, but it was kind of going on before that, where there were pushes here and there to rename schools, to rename roads and counties or whatever. Can you think, was there a particular time 20, 30 years ago, maybe even more, when this started? Where was the first snowflake that became the avalanche?
You know, it's funny, especially one of the figures that I talk about in my book is Christopher Columbus. Mm. And Columbus has actually been under attack a little longer. He was really featured in A People's History of the United States, written by Howard Zinn in 1980. Really took a hatchet to Columbus. And I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and a lot of this stuff was happening before it was happening around the country. 1992, you had big Columbus Day around the country. Berkeley, of course, changes it to Indigenous People's Day, which at the time people kind of, okay, you know, Berkeley, they're crazy, whatever. People still love Columbus. He's an American hero we can all celebrate. But it's really ramped up since that time. I mean, this year I think was quite incredible. We had here in the District of Columbia, I mean, this is the city named after Columbus, where they held an emergency session of the D.C. City Council. An emergency.
I know. I love it. I love that it was an emergency piece of legislation. Like, we've got to do something now.
Right now. You know, murders are up this last year, but we got to do something now to change this. And look, you've had counties all over the country changing names, taking down statues. In New York, you had this commission that was targeting Columbus statues for removal. You know, that's a really fast pace. And I think we are seeing the fruits. I mean, you can see the kind of acolytes of Howard Zinn today who, look, if you ask a younger American today, what do you think of Christopher Columbus? You ask somebody who may be in school right now, say, oh, I know he's a bad guy. And that's about all they know. And they're getting that from their schools. And look, that kind of indoctrination has happened for a long time. We're seeing the fruits of that now, and we're looking at one historical figure after another having to go.
Let's start with Columbus, because you do write about him in your book, and you were on my wife's radio show in D.C. here last year talking about this. And every year it seems ready-made for this, and they just find a way to go crazier. The left acts as though nobody would have discovered that the world had another half to it. And, you know, it wasn't like Christopher Columbus brought over jars of diseases and just flung them out to the natives. Human beings in Europe, in the Western, the Eastern Hemisphere, the other hemisphere, had diseases that they'd had. And then over here had diseases that they'd had. And neither side had a particular immunity to either one of them. So a lot of the so-called genocide it was accidental, but it's ascribed as though Columbus was like picking crew members based on how sick they were so that they could come over and infect the natives.
You know, it really is incredible. And they do pin that on Columbus. And it's amazing. I mean, we talk, and that is most of the destruction that happened in the New World was because of disease. Something that, believe me, Christopher Columbus had no concept of what disease actually was.
Right.
And a lot of those diseases did spread back and forth from that's what happens when you have populations that have been separated sometimes by thousands of years. I mean, you do have the spread of disease like that. I have to remind people, I mean, especially because of the fruits of what Columbus did led to the creation of many countries in the New World. I mean, we think about, you know, Western civilization was brought to the New World. We think about modern medicine, which is very modern. I mean, a lot of these diseases weren't even identified until the late 19th, early 20th century. And to a certain extent, that's the fruit of Columbus going across the water and discovering this new world. We wouldn't even have any concept of these diseases if it wasn't for that. And so this idea that this is Columbus's fault and that everything that happened in the New World after should be blamed on him, it's a bad mentality. I think that is a lot of these attacks that have happened on Columbus, because they simply see it as, look, America just really shouldn't have existed, period. Mm. And I think that's really where this is coming from.
That's the root of this is a dislike of this country. I don't know that it's necessarily this country, the geography of it, but it's what this country represents. It's the last bastion of true liberty at where it doesn't matter where you were born. Where you were born has no bearing on where you end up in life. Everything you do in between those times does. And that is essentially the antithesis of socialism, which is really their end game and their desire. But Columbus, why does Columbus still, because I get the activists. I get it. That's what they do. And they're ready to be outraged. They have a hair trigger and they want it. They need to be outraged over something. But then there are so many people that, especially younger college and high school students, are susceptible to it. Not just he was a bad guy, but he was a bad guy, we must take to the streets, we must rip this down, we must change this. Where does the radicalization ramp up come from? Because it seems so much easier now.
Yeah, you know, I think it's because these activists, they are acting as sort of the moral authority. I mean, when we talk about, especially this is ramped up, you talk about cancel culture and things like that. You find one bad thing about somebody, destroy them, get rid of them, literally wipe them from existence, wipe all memory of them. And I think that's really what they're trying to apply to history. A lot of these activists, look, I don't think most people in this country are like most of the activists who go and tear down statues and throw things at them. There's a small minority. But those people do act as kind of moral arbiters in this thing. And nobody, of course, you say, well, do you want to support this guy who's this horrible racist? You say, no, of course, I'm not a racist. You say, well, if you support Christopher Columbus, you must be a racist. And people, I think they're afraid. And a lot of them don't know simply what the historical record is. You know, you're approached by somebody who is a left-wing activist. They've read a People's History of the United States. They throw things out that sound like, oh, this person must know the truth. This sounds pretty serious. So they back away. And I think it's a combination of very engaged activists plus a lot of Americans who are afraid to kind of take that stand. I mean, do you really want to be associated with people say, oh, you're a racist for defending Columbus or these statues? People don't want to be associated with that, and they get afraid, and they back down when they really shouldn't. They should take a step back and say, you know, why is it that in our nation's capital, we have a giant statue of Christopher Columbus at Columbus Circle? Maybe there's a reason why the founding fathers thought that they should honor Christopher Columbus. There's a reason why generations of Americans did. Instead, take a step back and say, these are the reason these things are here. This is the reason why Americans once celebrated these things. Instead of taking these things down and being afraid to defend them, learn more about these people. Learn more about their legacy. It's the great legacy of our country. Do we really believe we live in a great country? I think there are a lot of people who say yes, but there are many more today that say no. I don't think America's
I can think of a
great
political party that is predicated on the answer being no. Talk a little bit about Howard Zinn, because I think there's 35, 40 years old, if you're over that, you don't know who Howard Zinn is, odds are. And if you are under that, you might not understand the bastardization of American history that he did, because he's probably taught to you as straight history. Tell us who he is, how he got to be so prominent, and why he's what he did was so bad. I'll just tone it down to bad.
Well, it was insidious what he did. In his book, A People's History of the United States, which I believe was published in 1980, Howard Zinn was a far left guy. I mean, he was a member of the Communist Party. He wrote this book called The People's History of the United States, which at the time was not taken all that seriously. Even by the academic left at the time just saw him as kind of a radical. He has a political agenda. A lot of his writings, especially about figures like Christopher Columbus, were coming straight from Marx and Engels. I mean, that's his narrative about Columbus, is that Columbus brought capitalism in this globalized world. And that's where he gets his history straight from. He used a lot of references in his book that are inaccurate or seemingly came out of the blue. He references himself. It's not very good history, but it's good ideological history. Mm-hmm. It's a very neat picture of America as a tale of oppressors and oppressed. You're either part of the oppressor groups or you're part of the oppressed. And it's a very powerful narrative. I mean, it feeds certainly into, you could say, the identity politics of today very, very neatly. And so his histories really took off. And there's something called the Howard Zinn Project, which pushed this curriculum in a lot of high schools across the country. I believe his book is now the most used textbook in a lot of schools across our country, which is quite frightening. And you can see why a lot of young Americans come out of that with a very skewed view of what our history is about.
But in popular culture, though, people like Matt Damon and Oliver Stone have embraced Howard Zinn.
They really have. It's really incredible the kind of – look, at one time, this was a fringe character. And look how fast the fringe became the norm. And I have to say, especially for younger generations, his histories have become the norm. I think that would have seemed wild, even to a lot of the liberal professors of the past. And frankly, it's up to us to undo this. It's really terrible. Unfortunately, a lot of our schools – a lot of our public schools have bought into this, and you're getting parents who say, hey, my kids, they're learning this stuff, and I don't know what to do. You know, it's one of the reasons why I support school choice so much, which is an issue that my wife works on. Because, look, this is what you get when you go to school. I got this when I was going to a public school in the San Francisco Bay Area. My parents pulled me out of that school. I remember the day my father – it was June 6, 1994 – my father asked, what did you learn in class today? Did you? And I said, well, nothing, writing these letters. He says, you didn't learn anything about the anniversary of D-Day. This is one of the most important days in human history. And so my father actually confronted the teacher and said, why haven't you taught my son about American history? You're not teaching him about civics and what it is to be an American. The teacher was very confused. So we had to write these letters and stuff. He says, well, you know, why don't you have them write a letter to one of the people who's there on that day and try to convey to these students, you're an American. This is what happened. This is your history. You should be proud of it. You know, dad said, hey, you know, my kid's not coming back to the school next year. And, you know, my parents put me in a private school. I think for a lot of parents, it is important to take these stands and defend American history and civics. And look, if you've got to pull your kid out of school, if you have to homeschool, if you have to send your kid to a private school, you know, that needs to be an option. So, and you know, a lot of this stuff was happening. It was starting in the 80s and 90s. Our generation has borne fruit, and it's even worse today.
Along the lines of what you just said about your own personal story, that was 1994, D-Day. Obviously, your parents were very involved in your education and noted it just happened very coincidentally be on that day that question was asked. But what red flags would you say are out there that parents who, you know, help their kids with their math homework. But history is reading. Maybe that's, you know, reading and writing is more important in the hierarchy of getting your learn on. So when you, what should parents look for as far as a red flag that maybe, just maybe, that their children are getting a bastardized version of history?
Well, it's funny. You just brought up math and science, and you would think that those subjects would
also be away.
We just had the story, of course, recently with Seattle introducing woke math, in which they're introducing a kind of ethnic studies into math, in which they teach students that Western civilization math is a bad thing and that you're oppressed, which is incredible.
That wasn't the end game.
Right.
You know, that wasn't the start point. There was a start point where they introduce it. You know, your first cigarette is far different than your 200th cigarette, and by then you're hooked. But the first one, you got a chance to make a difference. Your second one, maybe. Where's the gateway drug, if you will?
Well, it does come in history and social studies courses, and I do urge, especially parents, to be very aware of what your child is learning in school and be informed yourself. If your kid does come home, be able to talk to them about American history, to be able to educate them. Use the 4th of July to say, hey, look, this is what America's built on. Have them read the Declaration of Independence. Have these small things that reinforce to your kid, because even if they go into an environment in which they're getting people who are saying many things that are different, the teachers, maybe they're using a People's History of the United States, they're using this text, you can at least give your child enough of an education so that they can think for themselves and say, you know, what I heard about Columbus in my class doesn't conform to what I've read elsewhere. I think this is wrong. You know, have some faith also in your children to educate them and inform them, so that when they're talking to their friends and their peers, they say, well, no, actually, I've read that Columbus wasn't such a bad guy. The founding fathers were really great. They really did mean all men are created equal.
And there goes the GPA as soon as this kid starts doing it. One of the things you write about is a tradition that's coming up, Thanksgiving. It's a feast. It's a time for family and to watch. I'm from Detroit, to watch the Detroit Lions lose to whoever they happen to be playing on that day. And most importantly, it's the day before Black Friday, when you get up at 3 a.m. and kick old ladies to buy a cheap TV. But Thanksgiving it should be celebrated. It's a time when the natives in this country helped in a very important time, in a time of need. The settlers weren't Americans then. Now that is, again, as everything is, including the time of day, is now racist.
Yeah, it's really incredible. I'm sure this year we will see the series of op-eds in Salon and Slate saying that, well, really, the pilgrims were bad. And you have – and really something I think it's pernicious that I've seen these things. You have nothing really to be thankful for this Thanksgiving.
A good rule of thumb for history is anybody who has buckles on their shoes is bad. That's just science. That's not me.
And I go back and defend the pilgrims and the Puritans. I mean, you know, really this concept, I mean, people hear this idea of this shining city on a hill. And this came straight from a speech by John Winthrop when he crossed the ocean. He wrote a speech on Christian charity, which is kind of a foundational. Again, America, United States did not exist, but the seeds of what we would become were beginning right there with the Puritans and the pilgrims. I think that day, Thanksgiving, was set aside, and it's actually very much a 19th century holiday. This woman named Sarah Hale, who wrote Mary Had a Little Lamb and things like that, actually advocated that Lincoln that Lincoln create a national holiday of Thanksgiving. And it really took off, especially during the Civil War, which Americans wanted to look back and be thankful for the fact that they even had a country at that point. So it is an important American cultural holiday that has brought in immigrants, that has brought in Americans of all different backgrounds. It's sad to see, especially on the far left, people attacking that legacy and that tradition, because it's one of the few things that really binds us as a country these days. I mean, Thanksgiving is one of those holidays that people all across this country really feel like they can celebrate. And it's a wonderful holiday. You give thanks for the things that you have in this life. And I think that's a message I try to convey in my book, too. You know, you should be thankful for the things that our country has given us. I mean, the world is full of tyranny. It's full of oppression. It's full of a lot of bad things. The fact that we have something here that's a little bit nice is nearly a miracle. And I think that people should be thankful for that.
Absolutely. Now, let's talk about the people that helped us get that. You alluded to the founding fathers earlier. Obviously, the founding fathers are just a bunch of slave-owning white racists who probably raped women. And again, this is what people are being taught, as absurd as that is. This standard, this idea of judging the past by the standards of the present, the ever-changing, conveniently malleable standards of the present is designed, I think, mostly to smear the character of the founding fathers. Of course they were imperfect beings. It was an imperfect time. We're imperfect beings. It's an imperfect time. We are trying to establish a more perfect union, not a perfect union, because the founding fathers were smart enough to recognize that we are not perfect and never will get there, but we should always be moving towards that, whereas today's revisionists seem to believe that we are perfect now.
And they do, or they think that by severing us from this history that they can create a more perfect future. I think that's a big part of their outlook. And it's really incredible, especially the attacks on the founding fathers. And I have a chapter on Thomas Jefferson in particular, because he's come under a lot of attacks recently for being a hypocrite.
Raping Sally Hemings.
Yeah, exactly. He's a rapist. He's a hypocrite. He really didn't believe those words. He said that all men are created equal. And people attack him for that. And I do wonder, you know, these people are attacking him. Thomas Jefferson spoke those words in the Declaration, wrote those words in the Declaration of Independence, a time in which slavery was very much a reality.
Right.
In the world. I mean,
there's very little
dissent from even these concepts. The standard by which we're judging them is the one that they set. And they were the ones who were brave enough in a time in which this was ubiquitous to say, no, this is actually something that's wrong that needs to be done away with, and became, of course, the inspiration for its eventual abolition at the end of the Civil War, something that, you know, obviously President Abraham Lincoln, who gave all credit to Thomas Jefferson for adding those words to the Declaration of Independence. I think that's an incredibly important thing to remember. And look, if we're going to judge these people as imperfect or fundamentally wrong, I mean, we're going to have a lot of empty pedestals, including our own generation for sure.
Well, the Tupac and Biggie busts, I think, will replace the founding fathers quite nicely. Where does it, along that line, where does it end? Where does it go? What happens to a society that whitewashes, its own history? Because nobody was saying, there was the George Washington could not tell a lie, he chopped down a territory and confessed to it, all of that sort of old wives' tale, the urban legend. But nobody really had delusion that our founding fathers were perfect beings, that they couldn't take baths because they floated on water. They were human beings. Yet by only focusing on the negative, in an attempt to remove the reverence, the rightful reverence for them, it strips the country in a lot of ways of an important parts of our identity. What are the end results of that, the long term, on the society that you're ripping out the roots of?
You end up a society with no past and no future. I think that's a big part of it. And I think especially in a country like the United States, which is a massive, very diverse country, you know, we have always been bound by our shared history. This is something that one time used to be shared, look, right and left, liberal, conservative. You could say, well, at least, you know, we all respect the founders, respect what we are as a country. We have differences over policy, but we have this shared tradition. And splitting that tradition and tearing it apart leads us to the future where ultimately people are boiled down to their ethnic identities. They're boiled down to, which I think is a large part of this process. And so we have no shared history. We don't understand even how to confront the things, the challenges we have in our own time, because we have no idea how these things were faced by people in the past who may have faced the same things. You know, how do we face our own moral dilemmas? It all seems very clear looking back. You could say, well, of course slavery should have been abolished. But how did we get to that point? What were the decisions these people made? How do you understand human nature if you don't know how human beings were 150 years ago? These were human beings just like us, you know, struggling in a world that is often very complex. You know, sometimes the heroes that you think are these, they're not always saints.
Right.
And a lot of times, you know, the man that had slaves is ultimately the reason why we've ended slavery. And we need to be able to deal with these complexities, because that's just how the world is. We're never going to have this utopian world in which all oppressions are gone and all isms and all bigotry. These things we will have to face as well. By creating this kind of whitewashed picture of what the past should be and the series of oppressions leaves us deeply unprepared to face the challenges of our time in the future.
Is it the ease with which simplicity is absorbed by the human brain that makes this so successful? You know, he's just a racist, rather than, by the way, he also cured cancer, you know, but still he must be, have murals taken down to him, things like that. Is it just, it's just easier, or is it laziness, a combination?
It's both. I mean, it was funny to me. It was like people were saying recently that we should, well, let's get rid of Columbus Day. We'll just call it Explorer's Day instead. So we don't want to offend anybody.
Let's honor Dora.
Yeah, exactly. But you know what? the greatest explorer of the last 500 years was Christopher Columbus. That story needs to be told. And I think it is very easy. Look, you had this recent problem with this mural in San Francisco of George Washington, yeah, in which it depicted slavery and a dead Indian. It's funny because the mural was done by a leftist in the 30s.
Right, trying to show how horrible the country was.
And they couldn't even take that. They had to take that down because, oh, there were some people who were offended by this. Take it down. It's like, well, wait a minute. That was originally, it was supposed to be showing the opposite. So that shows where people are right now. It's that anything that offends, and of course everything offends, needs to be removed. It needs to be abolished.
Offended that you said that. But it's not, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about Christopher Columbus, talking about the founding fathers, but the revisionist history, the rewriting of history, is not just then. It's within people's lifetimes, and some of the most important events, one of the last chapters, the American century. That's not, you know, the 18th century that you're writing about there. It is a continual process. One thing about the left that's much better than the right is they can multitask like crazy. That's the benefit of a hive mind. Everybody goes at it from every different direction. Talk about the bastardization of the 20th century.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think most Americans would still say that World War II was the good war, that we played the right role. And I do wonder, especially these people who turn America into this, you know, boogeyman of a history of oppression, how is it that America played this critical war in this good war? You know, what were the qualities that made us a country so that we could stand as a bastion of freedom? And, of course, you have these revisionists that say, oh, the Soviet Union really won the war and things like that.
Yes.
And you get these kind of things, too. It's like, if the Soviet Union won the war and there was no United States, we're simply replacing one tyranny, horrible tyranny, for another one.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't take much to see what's going on.
They wouldn't have stopped at Berlin.
No, they would not have stopped at Berlin. And it's not hard to see, especially today with modern communist China, what our world would be like with the Soviet Union at the middle of human affairs. It was the United States and not Nazi Germany, not the Soviet Union. And maybe today we'll say not communist China that's at the center of human affairs is an important one. And you didn't get that United States without this long history that came before, without the generations of patriots and ideas that made Americans what they are. Those people who fought in World War II, their grandfathers, many of these people today would just simply, oh, they're racist from another time. These are the people that destroyed evil. They destroyed Nazism. They destroyed the most anti-Semitic regime in human history. We should know those stories. We should teach those stories. We shouldn't just look at it like, well, those people in the past, our grandparents, bunch of racists, write them off. These are the people that ultimately made this free country we call the United States. It's worth understanding them at the very least and saying, you know, maybe they had some good things to say to us. Maybe these people sacrificed heroically so that we could live in a free country today. Maybe we should think about that instead of destroying their statues, instead of tearing them down and destroying them.
Thank God we didn't have Twitter back in World War II, or everybody, Audie Murphy would be, you know, history's greatest monster. Mention Ronald Reagan to a committed liberal today, and they still convulse into a Tourette's fit. The man has been dead for 20 years and been out of the White House for 30 years. The left holds a grudge. Who, in your estimation, as one of the experts wrote the book on this, is the one that will convulse a liberal into Tourette's? Not him. They're the worst. And Christopher Columbus being accepted because he's history's greatest monster, clearly. But in an actual United States history, who is the one that, if the left had one bullseye to put on the map of our history, what do they want to take out the most?
It's got to be the founders. I mean, I really think it's them. Because, of course, you look at the long history of the United States, what we are really does come down to what they did, what they started. And, of course, the cultural foundation of liberty that comes from them, I think that's the main – it's been very hard for them to attack the founders because they've been so universally admired and revered. So they start with the lower hanging fruit. It's always easier to go for the lower hanging fruit. You know, that's, I think, why, and to a certain extent, it was easy to kind of go after the Confederates and say, oh, by the way – Jefferson said some bad things too. But by the way, George Washington, maybe he's not so good either. They start with that low-hanging fruit.
And Benjamin Franklin. Slaves,
look, you can go one after another. Recently, Gandhi was canceled because they dug up some writings of Gandhi. So I think that's what it comes down to. It's been a tough challenge for them. In the past, I think the left has often co-opted the founders. You know, FDR had his second Bill of Rights and things like that. But the new left of today that kind of is that generation, you know, post-Howard Zinn, post-1960s, they have a very different ethos. ethos. They're attacking the very heart of what this country is. And I do hope that in my book, I explained what the heart of the country is and why it's ultimately good and worth preserving. It's worth defending. And it's easy to be proud of these things.
Couple last questions, Jarrett. When you sit down to write a book, you've done most of the research in your head, even though you still have to do the actual research. You have an idea of what you're going to put down on the page. In the course of your research, in the course of filling in those blanks, what surprised you the most? What did you learn? You sat there and you go, oh, wow, that's not what I expected.
I didn't expect the kind of the depth of the attacks on American history. I think that's what's so shocking to me. And maybe I shouldn't be surprised at this point. I mean, we've seen attacks the simple rapidity from the fact that they went from Confederates to Jefferson to even Abraham Lincoln. I mean, there was this one story I uncovered. University of Wisconsin has an Abraham Lincoln statue. There were students who were protesting there. And they are protesting various things. And one of them actually said, well, the reason we want to take down Lincoln is because he owned slaves. And I thought, well, that really is something. I mean, you wouldn't even be bothered by to look up, you know, who this guy was before you decided to go after Abraham Lincoln. Should be almost a no-brainer.
First of all, you should sue everybody who's ever called themselves a teacher and had you in their classroom because they did you a massive disservice.
Exactly. So, you know, I think it's the combination of the speed at which this movement has now gone in the last few years, and the number of figures who are now under attack is quite stunning. Also, frankly, a lot of the ignorance in some of these attacks as well. I mean, there isn't even any kind of sophisticated attack on history. It's just, well, it's a statue of some older-looking guy, must be bad, tear it down, blow it up, burn it. And maybe it shouldn't be surprising. Obviously, you know, revolutions like this sometimes go very quickly. But it is stunning. I mean, these were once universally admired figures in our history. The idea that you would take down, a statue like that, even 20 years ago, would have been almost unthinkable.
If you have to Google who is on the statue to be offended by the statue, the problem is you. Last question for you, Jarrett. When somebody puts this book down after turning the last page, they're done with it, what do you want them to think?
I want them to feel pride in their country. I want them to feel pride in what this country is, what it's about the people. It's about the ideas and the people who ultimately built this country. And I want them to think, how can I take action myself? You know, in my conversations, in my school, I mean, with discussions with neighbors, to defend our country's history. And sometimes it's hard because there are a lot of people who make wild attacks, some of them based on ignorance and some more malicious. I want them to take the information from my book and have these discussions and not be afraid to defend your country's history. We have a lot to be proud of. Not everything in this country's history is something to be proud of, but most of it is. And there are a lot of great things, and you should be willing to do that. And I hope that I give you the information that you need to go out and make these arguments and make these defenses of a country that I'm sure most of your listeners are very much proud of.
And if they aren't, stop listening. Although there are a lot of foreigners who listen to, I get the emails. You can keep listening. The only way the lies win is if people stop telling the truth. And the war on history, the conspiracy to rewrite America's past, is the truth. Jarrett, congratulations on the book. After we're closed here, I'm going to have you sign these books, and you can enter to win a signed copy of the book. You just email me, Derek@dailycaller.com. Let me know that you want to be entered, and you're not just telling me to buzz off. And you'll be entered if you have bought the book or if you're inspired to buy the book, if you send me a picture of you with the book, not in a Barnes & Noble, not in a bookstore, or a screen capture of your receipt, you'll be entered twice. It's just that easy. Jarrett, nice to meet you. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Appreciate the conversation.
There you go. That was Jarrett with two T's at the end, not Jared. I don't know if you can tell because my nose is stuffed up and it sounds different in my head because of that. So I want to make sure you get it right. And the book, The War on History, The Conspiracy to Rewrite America's Past. And you can enter to win all the same ways you always enter to win. And we'll do the drawing next week. Next week, we're scheduled to have my buddy, good guy, what a great guy, David Limbaugh on the show. So looking forward to that. He's got a new book out next Tuesday called Guilty by Reason of Insanity, Why Democrats Must Lose or something like that. It's a great book. Actually, I've got it. He mailed me a copy of it, a signed copy. Yes. Guilty by Reason of Insanity, Why the Democrats Must Not Win by David Limbaugh. That'll be next week. Don't even bother trying to enter now. That's just not going to happen. Okay, The audio that I promised before we get to the Greg Jarrett. See, we went to Greg Jarrett to Jarrett Stepman. If there was somebody out there with a first name of Stepman, I think I would have been legally obligated to have them on the show next week instead of David, just to keep the chain going. But the closest I know of is Stedman, who's Oprah's boyfriend, and he won't return my calls. All right. Cast your mind back to when the Kavanaugh hearings were going on, not the circus that was happening in with the Democrats on the actual Judiciary Committee in the Senate, but the protests that were happening in and around the Capitol, the outrage that was going on there, the shouting, the chasing down of people, the showing up at people's houses, the banging on the doors of the Supreme Court, the crying, the whining, the yelling, the screaming, the fighting. And remember when Republicans referred to that as a mob, referred to them as a mob. Now, they only referred to them as a mob because they were acting like an angry mob. And the media universally was outraged that somebody would dare refer to these people simply exercising their First Amendment right to protest as a mob. So you have this little montage put together by the Washington Free Beacon. David Rutz over there, I believe, did this, of media being mad that the liberal mob was referred to as a liberal mob.
They are protesting. They are not an angry mob.
We are subhuman. We're done being polite.
Answer your question that you asked to her. Is it mob behavior? No, it's
Ma'am, you gotta get arrested.
He's created this idea of a mob.
But calling them mobs in the way that the leader McConnell has done is just wrong.
In the Constitution, you can protest whenever and wherever you want.
We believe in
It's a go watch. Put up the video.
A mob. Stop. Stop.
Excuse me, ma'am. Are you trying to assault me? This is assault.
Yes, Sarah.
In this kind of like racialized mob language, this kind of Nixonian law and order language that we're hearing.
The angry mob, the angry mob, the angry mob, even though these were just peaceful protesters.
Republicans are running on this idea that the left is an angry mob.
Wherever you come down on Brett Kavanaugh, describing protesters as a mob doesn't fit the facts.
That's not a mob.
Kill her three-year-old child.
Which side was more mob-like? Clearly it was the Republicans.
The president is trying to go too far with some of this rhetoric, you know, his talk of mob rule and so on. Mm-hmm. I mean, Brooke, have you been to a Trump rally?
Yes. No, no group of liberals being complete asshats would be complete without Jim Acosta putting the cherry on top of it. Now we smash cut to today, to yesterday, last 48 hours, when Republicans in the House of Representatives protested against Democrats holding an impeachment inquiry in secret, in private, keeping it from the public and keeping it from other members of Congress. That protest, a protest, was, guess what it was referred to by our friends in the liberal media? Everybody you're going to hear right now is a liberal in good standing in our media. Journalists, people like Donnie Douche, actually every, you'll probably recognize most voices. They, A, call them all a bunch of white guys, even though they're not, and there are a lot of women involved as well, but that's the way the left is. Just like they say something is a debunked conspiracy theory, a way to dismiss in liberal world anybody is just to say, well, they're white. What are you going to do? They're racists, but they're the ones who would scream racism from the top of the mountain, so it's okay. They get away with it. Nobody ever thinks they're a racist, but liberals really are racist. Listen to this montage of calling them a bunch of white guys and a mob back now that you know that the left was very, very upset by the worse use of the word mob to describe their fellow Americans simply protesting.
Republicans storm a closed-door impeachment hearing.
Our Republican colleagues evidently have freaked out.
It's a pathetic stunt.
And quite honestly, it looked like a mob scene.
A shocking scene today on Capitol Hill, one that some Democrats say resembled a mob.
I mean, these congressmen today rushing into a secure briefing like a mob.
In this country, we have the rule of law, not a rule by mob.
Republicans on the Hill stage a flash mob when they're not flash mobbing.
Acted like a mob.
It looked like a kind of a mob party.
Had that mob mentality.
I don't know what good that news cycle did them because they looked like such jerks.
Those white guys, those middle-aged, boring, nerdy-looking white guys.
I haven't seen a group of white guys that angry since they found out their Don Henley tickets were obstructed view.
You just saw a bunch of white men, and I just thought to myself, this is not what America looks like right now. What
happened yesterday was a high school prank by a bunch of 50-year-old white men.
These pathetic weenies walking down that step like lemmings.
Looks like a protest outside a pharmacy that ran out of Viagra.
The closest thing to, quote, civil unrest that they have ever seen.
Have you ever seen anything like what Congressman Gates did today?
Of obnoxious political behavior, this ranks high.
How pathetic. And Willie and I were just talking, just as men, how do you go home and look at your wives and look at your children?
Well, I think pathetic
people.
Yes, Donny Douche, they are all pathetic, pathetic people. They're your colleagues in media. What a difference party makes, isn't it? People literally attacking people, not a mob. Not a mob at all. People protesting, elected officials protesting that we, the American people, don't get to see what is going on a so-called impeachment inquiry. Well, that's an angry mob of nothing but no good white folk. White people are the worst. These people are such racist, they make me sick, and when bad things happen to them, I shall feel good about it, because it will be deserved. All right, that is all the show we have, but we still have some business to conduct. I have some books to get away. So I go to this, I found this website, this is how we do it. Tons of entries, and then there's a website, miniwebtool.com/random-picker, but that's it. And you enter in all the names, and it selects them at random. And the way I do it is I put them all in there, and I hit the thing 10 times. I'll do it really quickly to reload. And whatever name is up there in the 10th time, it's like spinning the hat or what the thing with the balls in it. That's the name I shall call. So here we go. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. The first winner is William Bentley. Congratulations, William Bentley. You have just won a signed copy of Witch Hunt by Greg Jarrett. I will be contacting you directly and getting your email or your actual address. I can't email you a book. And number two, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I knew it was going to be a name I'm going to butcher, and I apologize in advance. Rajan Kumar or Rayan Kumar? It's R-A-J-A-N. Rajan Kumar, congratulations. You have won the second signed copy of Greg Jarrett's book, Witch Hunt. I will be contacting you directly to get your mailing address. If you didn't win, I think there's still another copy. I'm not going to give it away this week. We're giving away the Jarrett Stepman books, two of those. And you will, right before Christmas, maybe not right before Christmas, maybe like 2 weeks before Christmas, I'll go through the box that I have of duplicates and extras, and there's everything pretty much I've given away to this point. I think I have another copy of, so that you have something to really go cheapo at Christmas or Hanukkah or whatever you want to celebrate, or just keep for yourself. You'll have that chance coming up. So you got to keep listening, keep spreading the word, keep telling a friend, and I'll keep appreciating all of it. The website, if you want to help with upgrading the show, is what is it? patreon.com/DerekHunterPodcast. Otherwise, you can just email me, Derek@dailycaller.com. If you want to win a copy of Jarrett Stepman's book signed by him, you can email that address as well. Have a great weekend. We've earned it. We'll be back here next week. See you later.
I don't know what good that news cycle did them because they looked like such jerks.